Well, I'm Jerry Barney, here to coordinate a session of, or a panel of experts this morning. We've been kind of struggling here together about our feelings that there needs to be development, but it needs to be a different kind of development. The sense that communism hasn't really proved to be the answer, and that capitalism, at least as it's seems to be manifested in the form of consumerism, seems likely to produce so much environmental damage that it may not be the answer for the long term either. So what we're going to do here is have some people who thought about this a bit talk about their sense of what kind of a system might work in the future, one that would provide development, provide justice, opportunity for people, welfare for people, but would also not put such a burden on the rest of creation as to be either unjust or unsustainable. And the panel that we have here to work with us includes Shelby Kaufman, Dick Fetzner, Becky Kemmery, did I say that right? And Jane Blewett. So, Shelby, would you like to go first?
sure. I'm going to start. I can start with a song. This is a solar carol. It's an Advent solar carol. Not a Christmas solar carol, because we don't sing Christmas songs here. But the melody will be familiar to you. And this ties in with what I want to think of. See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth. So expensive energy, so strikes me as really ironic that, well, first of all, I want to say I'm the furthest thing from an economics expert. And
I can't even keep my checkbook balance, so I'm going to talk about some things that have interested me or that have touched my life, but that does not necessarily because I'm knowledgeable about those or because I have a particular big picture to present. Scientists, like scientific commissions, commissioned by presidents and so forth, since Dwight Eisenhower, have advocated solar power as part of the answer to an energy resource problem. And it's been really striking to me that it's so typical of humankind that instead of accepting the gift of solar energy that's free and is all over the world, which is God's gift and the most basic source of power, we instead try to be like God and split the atom and do what the sun does in a general sense, and provide energy in that way, in a way that's has much more dire consequences and is much more expensive. But part of the movement for hope right now is that in spite of the relative indifference of government and indifference of large businesses or even hostility of large businesses to solar power, there is a grassroots movement to develop it. And I'm not really qualified to describe that, except I know that there's literally many thousands of experiments in solar power that are being conducted by people themselves or by small organizations. Almost every neighborhood I've lived in, including West Philadelphia, has solar collectors and people building greenhouses and things to take advantage of this free gift of God, which is solar energy. Solar energy is one part of a large field which is characterized different ways, but it's called a movement for appropriate and sustainable technology. Sort of an awkward term, I'll give it, but it's people who are experimenting with ways to come to grips with the energy crisis and the fact that the forms of energy we use are very destructive to the environment. And some people here may know more about this than I do, and I really encourage you to chime in later on. I'll just talk about one organization that I know of and another that I belong to in this regard. There's an organization called the New Alchemy Institute on Cape Cod. And the New Alchemy Institute is a small nonprofit group of people who for something like 15 or 20 years now have been experimenting ways that single households can take charge of their own energy and space needs and food needs. And they've done some really amazing, using things that are readily available to them, things that people themselves can build or easily buy. And they've done some really remarkable things there. For example, they've raised a garden which through time has produced enough, most of the food that one person needs on the equivalent of a tenth of an acre, which is a dramatically greater yield than what Jerry told us we now depend on, which is 4/10 of a hectare. I forget how hectares and acres translate, but it'd be a small fraction of the current rate of land use. And this is by using French intensive gardening efforts and so forth. And of course in Japan, where folks have very little land to use, they farm their earth a lot more intensively. They've experimented with easily constructed windmills that can generate people's own power, can generate all the electricity for a household. In Virginia, I lived near someone who built a windmill and used it, and he sold power back to the company. He had a surplus of power, and the company bought electricity from him. In the area of passive solar heating, as I understand it, and again, somebody can maybe elaborate on this or correct me if I'm off the beam, a lot of the residential space needs and hot water needs, which is a substantial part of our energy use, can be provided way up into Canada by using the appropriate technologies. And New Alchemy Institute has developed a lot of different forms of passive solar. One of them is uses a large black tank to actually trap and store the heat and radiate the heat. It's a very efficient thing. It holds several hundred gallons of water. And it turns out that in the tank of water, you can raise a species of algae-eating fish, which is a very good food source and virtually takes care of itself. So they developed a food thing that's a combination of a solar collector and a food source. So these are just glimpses of new possibilities that I think are being developed at a grassroots level. And because they're at a grassroots level, they're much less visible to us. You know, they're not big, but they're very widespread. And I think if we look around our neighborhoods, and probably many of you have had places where these types of things have touched your lives. So I think I don't know what a new economic order would look like. I think it may be very difficult for us to see right now what that would look like. Just like people in the Middle Ages living under feudalism, you know, even if they had some merchants around starting a capitalist thing, they couldn't envision what we have now, what a capitalist system would look like. And I think we're having a problem stretching our imaginations too. Imagine what a new order would be like that's not based on the profit motive, but we just know that there's problems with it. But I think it's you know, the Futurist organization had a slogan, think globally and act locally. And I just kind of invite us to think small or look for small, local, creative ways that these things can happen. There's another organization called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I haven't heard from them for years, but for a long time in Washington, D.C., they were doing the same thing in urban neighborhoods, how people could grow on the rooftops and so forth, a fair amount of their yearly food supply, you know, and how they can reduce and change their energy requirements, even in an urban setting. A community I lived in, we have 5 minutes?
Yeah, that's the theory.
Okay. Well, I'll try to close in this part. I lived in a community that, Dick hit it right on the button, it's like the kibbutz. It's called Twin Oaks Community in Virginia. It's about the same size as Holyoke Village now, about 70 or 80 people. And it's an income and labor sharing community. We practice economic equality. All income, except for some personal spending money, is held in common. We operate and everybody owns in common the industries and so forth. And it's a non-religious, non-charismatic leader type of community. And while I was there, we lived on about an average income of about $3,000 per person. That was the net income that we had. But our standard of living was probably the equivalent of about $10,000 or $15,000 per year. And the reason that was because we raised a lot of our own food, we took care of our own cars, and we shared. We had a fleet of vehicles just like Holden does. You know, we had 70 people living quite comfortably with 10 or 15 cars. And so with that way, we had wood heat and passive solar heat provided virtually all of our space heating and our water heating things. And we didn't, you know, this is just folks who got together and built this. It's been going now for about 22 years. There weren't any particular genius or any, you know, innovative magic that did it. It's just a commitment to those kind of values. And I think as a result, Twin Oaks is like one little experimental model in how people can live more lightly on the earth and live with forms of satisfaction other than material, and can make it even while we're still in a capitalist world. There's things that we can do, creative things we can do as a community that can help the earth.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Dick, you want to go next?
Okay, new economic order. I think I'll look at it at a little different perspective than Shelby did, and look at the present economic orders that we identify. One being capitalism, and we say we know what it is. We know the things that are wrong with it. It's exploitative of people, of resources, of our environment. It's focusing basically on individualism and on the profit motive. Another form, which at the other spectrum we call communism, I don't know if we've ever seen communism on the earth. Truly practiced, maybe what Shelby's talking about here, Twin Oaks, maybe the kibbutzes of Israel, are as close as we've come where you have complete communal ownership and action. What we've seen in place of communism has been some step toward it, which is still dominated by bureaucracy and authoritarianism in Russia and in most of the where we've seen it planned in Eastern Europe, essentially planned economies, very, very heavily on the bureaucratic side. On the plan, everything is planned from above, not only what you'll produce, but how you'll produce it, where you'll produce it, and what price you'll charge for it. In other words, completely non-market driven, whereas the capitalistic society is market driven. In other words, the market will decide what's done. There, in communism as we know it today, the bureaucrats will decide what's done. Neither of these are working as desirable as we'd like to see them work. We're seeing the latter collapsing right now in most every place it's being practiced in Europe, Eastern Europe, in Russia. Considerable interest in trying to move this economic system, it's both a political and an economic system, in a direction where it's more productive, in the direction of maybe some market involvement. In between, we have something called socialism, another economic concept from which communism derives. And socialism says, in communism, the state or the people own all factors of production. Capital, banks, everything belongs to the government. In socialism, not all factors of production, and labor is a factor of production. In socialism, the government doesn't necessarily own labor as a factor of production. It may not own others. It owns those factors of production that are really crucial, the power plant and things like that, maybe the banks and so forth, to society as a whole. And we see a representation of socialism that may be a good combination in the Western European countries today of Sweden and Norway, Denmark, and maybe Eastern Germany, where we have democratic socialism occurring. And democratic socialism is a combination of free market and socialistic concepts that have a bigger focus on people and on the interests of the community. Now, we call them, a pejorative term is welfare state. We call them welfare states. Cradle to grave concern for people, but maybe that's the concern. Once a person, an individual, has his welfare needs taken care of economically, then he doesn't have to exploit environments and exploit ecologies and so forth in order to achieve profit. There's drawbacks again for the social democracies of Western Europe. They have tremendously high tax rates on the population in general. You can very rapidly be in the 50% tax bracket. Something's got to pay for all of this. But they have some of the finest medical care in the world as compared to the United States. They have a very fine education. Everybody gets educated. They have some of the highest levels of literacy and education rates in the world. And incidentally, if I go back to yesterday's lecture and look at GNP per capita, they have some of the highest GNP per capita in the world. So I kind of look at social democracies and say, I wonder if that isn't maybe a direction of the new order. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's not destroy our market, the market drive, because it's the market drive that leads to innovation. It's the innovation that's going to do all the things that we need. In other words, to capture the sun is going to take a lot of innovative technology, which probably will not come about without some kind of a market drive causing it to occur. It could. I'm not saying it won't, but I'm saying it's going to come about quicker. If innovation can be, an incentive for innovation can remain. To lose that incentive for innovation by destroying market drive could be the biggest loss we have. On the other hand, when the market dominates everything, that's creating our problem. So I think we've got to look at some way to tame the market drive. I think I just used 5 minutes.
Okay, Becky?
Would you give me a sign of that?
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you. That set this up very nicely. What I'm saying is we'll be drawing largely from Roman Catholic social ethics. And I think as a Protestant, I can say that Roman Catholic social ethics are probably, one of my profs used to say, about 20 years ahead of the rest of not only Protestant social ethics, but social ethics in general. And I'd just like to throw out one bit of theological information that I found helpful in exploring why Roman Catholic social ethics are so far ahead. Protestants theologically tend to start with the fall of humanity and the fall of the world in their theologies. And they move not from creation through the fall to redemption, but often from the fall to redemption. Catholics, on the other hand, tend to start with creation and, if anything, overlook the fallenness and move to redemption. But what I find in Roman Catholic social ethics is that there's a very strong sense of the dignity of the human person, each person, and I think also potentially a strong sense of the dignity of creation. Whereas in Roman Catholic social ethics, in Protestant social ethics, as in Protestant theology in general, there's a tendency to set up a dichotomy between us as the redeemed and the rest of humanity, and us as the redeemed or as people and the rest of creation, because creation is somehow fallen as well as the rest of humanity. Jane gave you a bit of historical background in her talk on the Roman Catholic. She talked about the Roman Catholic social encyclicals, papal encyclicals, the first of which came out in 1891. Basically what happened in those was initially there was a fear of communism, and so there was kind of a speaking out against communism. Then with Vatican II in the early 1960s, there was a shift in Roman Catholic social ethics, and they started also warning against capitalism and some of the problems with capitalism. So basically, Roman Catholic social ethics at this point falls into the category of, if they're promoting any system at all, it would be a modified socialism. And I call it a modified socialism because socialism tends to be equated with Marxism in the States. On an international level, thinking about development, Roman Catholics have said that true development should consist of more than the accumulation of wealth and the greater availability of goods and services. So true development must consider the social, cultural, and spiritual dimensions of the human being. And I think that's probably the most important thing they're saying. And I would add to that, because Roman Catholic social ethics at this point haven't dealt a lot with creation and ecology, true development also needs to deal with the preservation and development of creation. On an international level, Roman Catholics say that war and military preparations are the major enemy of the integral development of peoples. So on a practical level, that means that money must be re-diverted from things that are death-giving to things that are life-giving. We also need to see, to develop a vision for the unity of the world and of the human race. This is a quote: "The nature of authentic development is this, that either all the nations of the world participate in it, or it will not be true development for any of the nations of the world." So we need to develop a sense of the interdependence of all the world and of all nations in development. Bringing that down to a practical level of how do I develop a company, or what would an economy look like, there are five principles, I think, that would apply. The first is the principle, what they call the principle of subsidiary function, and you might also call that decentralization. And that is this, that every possible function of society is managed at the lowest possible level. So the family manages as many functions as possible in society. Then the next level might be the church or the small group, small social group. The next level might be the local community. Those groups manage as many functions of society as possible, and only those functions of society that those that that level can't manage are then managed by the larger level. So decentralization or subsidiary function. And some of the reasons for that are that the smaller group knows its members better, understands the group's needs and the individual's needs better than the larger functioning group. And I think also the smaller group is more closely related to the creation around it. So rather than having the federal government deciding whether a mine should be placed here or there or whatever, those sorts of decisions are made or influenced as much as possible at that local level. Okay, the second principle would have to do with the organization of work and employment. And that is this, that work exists for the good of the human person, not the human person existing to provide a product or to provide a means of making profit. So that's an answer to the profit motive. It's a, as Jesus did, it's turning a way of seeing things on its ear and upside down. I think the way our North American society runs, we tend to see production as a machine, and people are simply cogs in that machine. They're means of producing a product that then provides a profit. And Pope John Paul II suggests that work exists for three reasons for the human person. One is to provide a means of livelihood. The second is as an outlet for creativity and personal expression. And the third is to provide a sense of worth. And this is all from memory, but as I remember it, that's what he said. So the purpose of production is not the product, but the purpose of production is the worker. And the work environment should express this. So the whole work environment needs to be geared towards the good of the individual person or the worker. A third principle would be participation in ownership of the means of production by the worker as much as possible, whether that's on a financial level or decision-making level. The worker actually participates in the company and the means of production. A fourth principle would be relating, and this might not be specifically from the Roman Catholic social but relating production to the needs of the community and to community development. And you might add to the needs of creation to that as well. So rather than the market or bureaucrats deciding what will be produced, individuals within the community or the group that's producing something decides what they will produce and relates that to the needs of the community and community development. So instead of deciding you're going to make a profit, setting out to produce a product, and then having to advertise to create a need or create a desire for that product, you actually base your production of a product on the needs of the community. And then a fifth principle would be limiting growth. That one example of limiting growth is saying that no one in the company would earn more than X amount. No one would earn less than X amount. No one would earn more than X amount. And that superfluous profit, you know, that comes in over what's needed to pay people's salaries could go into community development. It could go into the development of individuals, more education for them or something like that. And I would just add to this in closing that these sorts of things have been done, as Selby said, with Twin Oaks. Another example is a business person named Sismondi who lived, I think, in the 18th century and who used this type of approach with his company. Another example of an alternative approach with alternative values is Holden Village. And all of these, I think, are examples of communities and situations that work. So they have been done, and they do succeed. I don't think that having a community or a a means of production, producing community that has different values, necessarily means that there will be problems or that it won't work, that it won't succeed as far as making a profit or meeting the needs of people.
Good. Well timed. Jeannie?
I think I'm just, well, no, I would just move over here so I don't have my back to.
I got up a little bit early this morning and went for a long walk along the road. And as I was coming back, suddenly this metaphor kind of seemed to come to me about what, you know, what it fitting for this morning's panel. And I, you know, as I walked along, there were tiny little delicate trails. It must have been a squirrel with its tail, you know, just making a little line across this gorgeous white snow. Oh, this tiny little tail and another little tail. So there were two of them going down, probably she going out to get food for the children or something. I went a little further, and there were very definite rabbit tracks. And they were just sort of in place along the way. And then in another place, I saw the deer track. And they're deeper into the snow, but also very discreet there and there. And then I looked at mine. And here are these big plowing, you know, these big grooves in the snow going along the way like this. And I'm thinking, I'm not so big, you know, and I wasn't trying to be distracted, but just, like, there's no way I can walk through that snow with the kind of delicacy and reverence and respect for that snow as those other creatures. And it just sort of said to me, that's a little bit of the metaphor maybe, that you know, I've been cast in this role as the visionary, whatever that means. But my hope is that before I leave Golden, something of the visionary will be the real. And so I just come at this morning, and like you, Shelby, I am not an economist. I do not pretend. So there's no effort in this to say this is the way to an alternative economic system. But what I think we have been reflecting together, you know, over these days, even in a variety of comments, is that there's something radically wrong with what is. And we've been kind of saying that in a lot of different ways. And one way to kind of address that, and I think Becky and some of the comments, would be to how do you remedy the situation? You kind of take the givens and try to remedy it. And how do we make our social, our economic system more responsible to poor people, to the earth? And we raise those questions. And all of it, practically all of Catholic social teaching, has been to adjust, to address the social agenda. How do we make things better for humans? My contention this morning is that the industrial economy is itself a non-viable economy in the long term. The industrial economy itself is non-viable in the long term. And I think most of our deep foreboding about in our own discussions would lead us to that, if we got down to where we really are. So my starting point is that there is no viable economic system unless it includes the total Earth community and is in harmony with the larger life economy within which it is conducted. So long as the human process is integral with the rest of nature, it is a viable option. It is a viable economy. But our present difficulty would lead us to say that a deep growing realization that our human economy is increasingly becoming bankrupt in its destruction of the technologies of the natural world. When nature goes into deficit, there is no further bottom line. That is the bottom line, when nature goes into deficit. And at present, our kind of reckless plundering of the land, air, the sea, the forest, what future can there possibly be? And we played our little game last night, our very instructive. That's the world. And as long as we continue to plunder, as if that world had no other meaning than for us, it is a non-viable economy. Few of the mainline economists or corporate position papers ever speak of the deficit of the planet itself. But what is the economy? Only that. This is not only a resource, and this is the point. It is not only like a resource deficit. You know, it's not only that we're running out of coal and oil and the kind of resources that we talk about, but it is the death of a living process. And not only a living process, the living process, the planet itself. It's just not a shortage of those resources, it's the death of a living process. Because the Earth lives together in one integral whole. And that's its only life possibility. So our problem today is infinite. We even say it is like in 65 million years, we are ending the last Cenozoic era and entering a whole new era. They call it the Ecozoic era. We've come to the end time of what our assumptions have been that we worked off of. No other historical period has faced this. So it is no longer tinkering with the system. We as a species are determining the destiny of the Earth. We as species are determining that. And within the last 200 years, in a way unprecedented in history. So I say it is an economics of the Earth community as a whole, or it is no real economics at all. And what is that word, economics? What does it come from? It comes from the Greek word oikos. Oikos is the root of the word economy, and that means household, the oikos. And when we talk about economics in its, you know, in its pure form, what we mean is, how do we provide for the household? How do we provide for the household? And it's the same root of the word ecology, oikos, the household. And what are the relationships within the household that keep that a viable household? That's what this study of ecology is. And today, the deepest ecological question we're raising is the relationship of the human to the earth. How are we fitting as species into this total household? And if our economic system is not in light of this total household, then it is not a real system at all. We have been living in kind of a fantasy world. So when we often say we're going to go out in the real world, we leave Holden to go to the real world. It's the reverse. It's the reverse. And not that Holden is the model, but at least the effort to come to grips with how you live in some kind of harmony with the total community around you. The natural world is not just an object to be pondered, it is subject. It is its own larger sacred community to which we belong. And that's why I keep saying we need to learn that journey of the universe. We have to go back and say, we came out of that. And that's where we belong. And unless we fit ourselves into that, we have no place. And the universe may very well go on without us. So the burden that falls on us is to find where we fit in that larger community. If we begin to see ourselves in that context, really locate our being within the earth as the consciousness of the earth itself, then our economic activity is in a new context. And that's what I call an effort to define a new economic order. That is an order within the context of that enlarged world. You know, this figure, I think is a very instructive kind of where we have blinders. You know, we live like this, and what's beginning to happen is our blinders are falling away, and we begin to say, hey, that universe around me, that world around me, that earth around me is my home. And I've got to learn how to live within that and not just off of it. Off. So in our industrial economy, that's our kind of process, to live off of the earth and not in it. And you know, it's like we've been in a trance. I even think in the Wall Street Journal, there isn't, I you know, you ride on airplanes. I'm so struck, if you ride some of the business airplanes, you know, the men, mostly men going off to work, every one of them behind the Wall Street Journal. And what does the Wall Street Journal say as its byline? The Diary of the American Dream. That's what the Wall Street Journal is. The Daily Diary of the American Dream. And that American dream, you know, that we live off of for the past 100 years is this trance that we're breaking away from. And you know, if you, Jerry, I think the question you should bring to this effort to kind of raise a mandate for the year 2000, to say, if you were the CEO, the chief executive officer for the planet, what record would you give to the operation that has been going on for the last 200 years? What report would you give to your board, other than the report of every two-thirds of the human community outside of the, not being able to live within this economic system, the earth plundered at every score, and we continue to say that's the system that has to exist. That's what we've got to maintain at any cost. So I say, if you can go around and get people to say, if you were the CEO, what account would you give of the stewardship that you have had of the earth today? And why are we afraid then to challenge, and these are the institutions. I say the primary objective of economic science, the engineering profession, technological invention, industrial processing, financial investment, and corporate management. Every one of them has been geared to letting us as a species live in an unreal way in relationship to the rest of the world. You know, you can say, wow, there is nowhere to turn. If we believe that we have to live within some other context, those same institutions are available to us to direct their energies towards that as the context. So it isn't as if there's nowhere to go, but it's how do we reorient what we already have as gift of human ingenuity to the task before us. And there are no quick fixes. And for Americans, that's anathema. We are a people of the quick fix. Mission impossible. Tell me today the problem, and tomorrow I have the solution. There is no way we're going to get out of that. But I do say that there is every possibility, and I so invite the young people here to turn your questions and your directions of your life to that question. How? Within those very techniques and technologies that we have. And, you know, everyone's proof texting around here. So I'm going to do a little of my own this morning. Just that, you know, when the covenant was established, the Rainbow Covenant, what was that? But a covenant between people and the earth. And the covenant said something like, me, Yahweh, and you, and every living creature on the earth. Every living creature, that's the context of our reality. And that's the context of our political system, our economic system, our religious system, our social system, our cultural system, legal system, educational system, whatever. That's the context of it. And that's the kind of transformation we're engaged in. So when, you know, people like E.F. Schumacher begins to say, kind of raise questions about more, you know, and an economics of enough. Enough. That's E.F. Schumacher, small is beautiful. An economics of enough. And a whole school of people that are trying to carry that out. And as you say, so many of them are hidden. They're small. There are efforts that are going on. You know, they're not there. You don't read about them in the Wall Street Journal. But they are the only viable context for the future. And I think if we start, you know, bringing those kind of groups within our sharing together, they present to us in the models and the hope, at smaller rather than larger, less rather than more. Shorten the distance between the product and those who use it. Schumacher kept saying that so much. The whole principle of subsidiarity, where are decisions made? And one movement that I think is so radical in its effort to address this is the bioengineering movement. And there are people in this country deeply engaged in it, trying to say, we learn to live within the natural confines of a place that is sacred, that supplies all the life support. And at another level, for the last 3, 4, 5 years, there have been a group of international economists, thinkers, international persons who gather every year at the time of the economic summit when the 7 industrialized nations have been gathering to review the economic arena over which they control. That's the signal. Anyhow, they just call it the TOES.
Watch out.
TOES, the Other Economic Summit, the TOES. And these groups of people, they have a good textbook out. It's called The Living Economy, edited by a man called Paul Ekin. That, why can't that be the text in our economic school? There are options that we need to explore to bring into our reality. So can I go back to that? Mondragon, many of you know about that, is a whole community of people that have been living off of this in Spain. There's several of you could talk about that. So I say it is not hopeless. There is the energy of the earth as our hope. But we have to give the earth its place if we have a final future.
Thank you. Well, I want to add a little bit here as a member of the panel and also as a transition into this. As I listen to all of the things that have been said here, James thought that the industrial economy is non-viable in the long term. I think I believe that. And I also believe she has a very good point that we need to look at the institutions that we have as tools for moving into a different way of doing things. If you want to throw it all out, there's a tremendous amount of social invention that's been there. And I don't know where one wants to begin in that. There's a lot that has to be done, but I'm going to suggest one thing that has occurred to me in a little bit of reading of economic history that I've done. And it has to do with the origin of the corporation. And we didn't always have corporations. And corporations began in England. It began with a charter from the king. You could get a corporate charter, but it was very difficult to obtain a corporate charter. And that the way that you could obtain a corporate charter was to propose something, some undertaking, that you would do that would certainly be economic gain for yourself, but it would also be a benefit to the empire, to the British Empire. And that was the condition. There had to be some benefit to the empire, and you couldn't get the corporate charter. Now, as time has gone on, other nations and even other states within nations have obtained the power to grant corporate charters. It's now a trivial thing to become incorporated. You need a group of people, 3 people, as incorporators, and you fill out a form, and anybody could do it. You get a lawyer to help you, but anybody could do it. You send in, depending on where you apply, it's somewhere between $50 and $150 to get to own a corporation. What it seems to me is that might happen as we go back to that original concept. Well, I should say that in exchange for doing this, you know, the key thing about a corporation is that it has a limited liability. You can't sue the people who are the incorporators or the stockholders. And that's the key social invention there, that it makes it possible to invest in a way in which you're not subject to torts and all of the kind of common law rules that have made it possible to sue people for individual action. A corporation can be sued only up to the assets of the corporation itself. You can't get at the people who created it. And that kind of legal protection has been very important in corporations. Now, what it seems to me that there's a possibility of doing in the future is something akin to what we do with radio stations and TV stations. That is, we impose an additional requirement on them for their existence. That you get incorporated, and then you apply to the Federal Communications Commission for a license to broadcast. And you can't do that unless you're performing a service to the community. That is a requirement. And there was a big scare for NBC when, about 10 years ago, a challenge was made to NBC that its kind of flagship radio station was not really performing service to the community. And there was a question for a while that NBC was going to lose its principal radio station because it wasn't in its broadcast, it was providing that kind of service. I wonder if there might not be the possibility of adding and imposing an additional requirement for the existence of corporations that, in addition to, sort of an analogy to the original idea of a corporation in England that had to serve the interests of the crown, that if everywhere throughout the world we can impose a condition that a corporation cannot continue to exist. Every year when it submits its annual report as to who its stockholders are, that it must also submit a report as to what it is doing to give service to the plan. And simply disallow the continued existence of any corporation that is not doing that. That, I think, might be a way of taking one of our social institutions and turning it around in a way in which it becomes a really positive kind of influence in the future. Okay, let's have some reactions to everything that the panel said.
I think one thing that jumped out and hit me, and I'll begin by apologizing for this, because what one notices usually is the thing that you do yourself, and I frequently apologize for what I think and believe. And each person said, well, I'm not an economist. Well, I wonder if one of the things we need to say, to do, and to change about our thinking is the way we handle sciences and the semi-exact sciences, and I don't believe economics is an exact science anyway. It's not predictive, it's not controlling. Why do we have to go back to them as our ultimate decision maker? Should these things not come from our hearts and from deeper sources of truth than what economics has to offer? Economics should be examining what is and explaining it and helping us to understand it, not telling us what to do. That was just what jumped out.
I think that is a very, you know, like there seems to be kind of no other field in a way that people feel, they keep saying, well, I'm not an economist, or the economy is sort of a sacred cow up there that no one would dare touch it, in a way, and yet all our lives are engaged in providing for ourselves in one way or another.
And that's why I really appreciate Dick being here, to be a bridge between a world that gets separated and us folks who don't think of ourselves as economic thinkers.
You know, economy is referred to as the dismal science. The dismal science. Why is it the dismal science? You say economy, you couldn't have a one-handed economist. Because they're always saying on the one hand this and on the other hand that. Economics is an extremely complex subject. And it is not a precise subject. It is not a precise subject. Like mathematics or chemistry. Physics. even though they give Nobel Prizes in economics as a science, I really question it to be a science. It's an art. It's an art form.
And kind of embedded in the assumptions and the culture and the, you know, the context of whatever society it's engaged in.
Oh, and another thing, excuse me, economics. You know, mathematics isn't politically influenced. Physics really isn't. Economics is greatly politically influenced. You know, a politician gets the economist that he wants to sell his case. We're constantly dealing with government reports. Now we have the administration giving out government reports that will give economic support to the particular policies that the administration is trying to pursue. You got to be careful what economist you're reading. You know, well, let's see now. I'm going to read this one or this one or this one. So, you know, we got to have an economist. First of all, tell me what your political persuasions are. Tell me about your religious background. On and on and on. Now I know how to listen to you. So don't be enamored with economists. They don't. You're very right. They don't carry that much water in their bucket.
But I think maybe one reason people want to rely on economists is that there's a fear that if they follow their hearts or follow their vision or follow alternative models, that an economic system will fall down. It will go to pieces. And especially in a country, in the U.S., which I see as a country that is run by money and the profit motive and materialism to its very core, and lives by that illusion, that's a tremendous fear in many people. I just, coming from Canada, I mean, living in Canada for part of the year and working in Alaska the other part of the year, I'm just amazed at the difference in values and the difference in mythology and the whole way of people seeing themselves.
I have a bit of a problem when people start talking about economics, that they want to find an ultimate answer. And I think that economics is just like a lot of other things in life. You go through processes, and you may go through something that simulates communism for a while until you need to do something different, and then you need to move into something that's more socialistic and more you know, profit motivated, and then you need to go back through. I don't think that you can ever land in the land of perfection as far as an economic model. I think it's a process and it changes. And that right now, it seems like Americans are gloating over what's happened to the communist world, and they're just pointing at it and saying, see, we've been telling you all along that it wouldn't work, that you were wrong. And who are we to be doing that? Look what's happening in our own country. We don't have the answer. They don't have the answer. It's not found in one simple somebody's model of how something happens. It's a process, and there is no the answer. I don't believe
that. I still think there are principles that can come out of a religious perspective or a Christian perspective. You know, so that the Christian economist or social ethicist or whatever theologian can speak prophetically into an economic system.
It seems like Jerry's comment that, you know, as a criteria for corporations being providing a service to the planet, that leans a little towards ideals of a Green Party. As a new alternative for a new option, you know, an economic system based on the preservation of the earth.
And where do we find the Green Party most has the greatest influence? What part of our
Western?
Where?
Western Europe.
Yeah, in Western
and
Europe,
declining
in the social democracies. That's where we find the Green Party having a major influence and growing influence.
No, the Green Party is losing power in West Germany. Because it reached a peak, and then the other parties recognized the ecological inputs that it was making to Germany and co-opted them. And the Green Party has been declining in popularity over the last few years. Now, it might reverse that, but I mean, at least that's the way it was last year.
Yeah.
But I would think that'd be the ultimate of success when you became, incorporated in the mainstream, your philosophy.
Right, right. I mean, I'm not saying it's not succeeded. Yeah. I think it has. It's forced the other parties to do it.
Brian, you had your hand up a little bit.
Yeah. Thank you, recorder. I guess when I listen to your five principles, I can only tell like my story, and my family started, my great grandfather started an optical business in 1897 in Ohio. And I was feeling my great grandfather was very ambitious. He was an adventurer coming from Pennsylvania. As I read through your five principles, that business still continues. I think it makes a 2% profit. Had maybe 16 employees. I worked for my father by choice because I believed in those values of small business for 5 years. And then I think I gave up because I didn't know how to compete with lens crafters. And I didn't see how it was going to survive with the medical healthcare plans that are available in corporations. Because if we couldn't be on their list, then our customers who have been coming to us for many generations, they have to make a choice between an economic, paying $10 for a pair of glasses, or coming to us and paying a regular price. And what amazed me is that some families did choose and chose to continue in that commitment. In my, my dad's family business, everything that can be given back to the employees is given back. I got mad because we didn't get raises, because all my friends get raises. And so he explained to me how much health care costs have gone up, and as our company continues to pay for those, the percentage that, if you include that in my, if I looked at that part of my pay, it was quite high. I got a raise every year if he was going to pay for my medical care, because as a small business in a community, the healthcare rates are so much higher because there's only so many employees. The decline of an interrelated community, Bexley is the Jewish community of Columbus. It maintains its own independence as a city within the city of Columbus. You can go to the grocery store and the bank and everything. And everything is, everyone knows each other. That small town atmosphere, and there's, I think in the Jewish community there is a real sense of community around their spiritual beliefs. And that's an old tradition. I guess what I see is that I couldn't see how we're going to survive. My father doesn't see how. He was very supportive of me leaving the business, which I was surprised, because he doesn't know what will happen. Small businesses abound, but with those values that have lasted since 1890, and they're called old-fashioned, my dad is like the ancient standard against my cousin who has computers and management and will learn to compete with lens crafters. So I guess I see this old model that I love and yet don't want to live with my whole life, and those values and And those were there, and that was capitalistic. And and yet it's not the same as it is now. And I guess my question for Dick was, I heard you talk very admirably of the West German and the Scandinavian countries, but what are what is that drawback? What is the other side of the coin for that economic?
Well, the other side of the coin that I see immediately is that they're very high tax systems. You say, well, you know, that's the price of progress, you know, you pay for it. In order to support a welfare state, you have to have a lot of funds. You're going to get it from two sources, from your economy, per se, your business, your industrial state, or from taxing the wages of people who work in it. The more you take money away from people, money is a reward for work.
It's security also.
Pardon?
Security.
Money, security, yeah. So, but if you don't need money for security if you live in a welfare state. You don't really need it.
Mm-hmm. That's
because the state's providing the wealth, the security. But the more you take money, the argument goes that money is an incentive for people to work. And if you remove the incentive of money, now there's all kinds of arguments. You know, you really work for Maslow's higher needs of self-actualization. I agree, but you cannot motivate a work. The theory goes you cannot motivate a workforce without giving them something. And the more you take away in taxes, the less you demotivate the workforce. And therefore, you demotivate innovation. And so there's some point here where you self-defeat yourself. The welfare state overcomes itself. And that's the problem. That's one of the failures of communism. There is very little incentive for people to work hard in the communist system as they exist in Russia today.
I think about me working at Holden all last year for no pay. And there is, I find in this community a lot of motivation to work.
But for a career, let me ask you if you want to do it for a career. It's a wonderful place to be for a year or two, three, maybe. How about a lifetime? Just a lifetime.
Yeah, if Holden continues to offer the extra that normal wage earning businesses don't offer, that is participation in the life of the business. And I think what most businesses have decided is that as an alternative to allowing you to participate in this business, deciding what this business is about, how it will function, you are bought off with money. You take your money and go somewhere else and run your church or run your community group or do something somewhere else. And that's, you're bought off for that. And in that circumstance, yeah, money becomes the price, and you take your money and you go somewhere else and you do it. But if your business includes you as your partner, then the financial incentive is needed.
My other observation about the community holding it is not representative cross-section of society. In no way is Holden representative society. This is the upper level of Maslow's self and self-actualization group.
Yeah, I want to keep both those hands in mind, but I wanted to say I don't think that it is the upper level of Maslow. I think that Maslow's hierarchy of needs refers to a group of people who are very different from the kind of people you find at Holden. I don't think Maslow's hierarchy applies here. I think you'll find here a large number of people for whom a kind of sense of spirit-led activity or influences the way in which they live, the choices they make, that is very different from anything you find in Maslow's theory. Maslow's theory simply doesn't have any kind of place filled into it for someone who asks themselves on a regular basis, what does God want me to do? And do that instead of, now Maslow's theory really kind of applies to, you know, the economic grasshopper, the person who is the essence of what I think this bankrupt economic theory that we're living by, more or less, now proposes as the ideal economic person. And I think part of what we really have to rethink is the fallacies in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that somehow there has to be something more than this strictly, I do everything for my benefit. That there's another way of looking at needs and what drives people. And I think that theory is. Now, which hand is up first? Let's take it.
But I think we should pick up on sometime in the conversation, and this is sort of a second thing, but what drives us and what drives a particular kind of economy. I hear everyone sort of alluding to that, and I think that's a very basic sort of thing, but just an observation about Holden, and I really agree with him. I think it's necessary to have places like Holden, and I love Holden because of that, where we can come and reflect. And but on a practical, economical level, Holden exists because of the outside world. I mean, because of gifts from other people and the gasoline that drives our buses up and down the mountains here. It doesn't come from Holden Village, and nor does most of the food and everything. So, you know, I mean, it's not, as a model, economic model, I'm not sure. It's, you know, maybe I'm missing something, but I don't know that it really applies. As a model of reflecting upon alternatives, it's you know, necessary. But.
No, and neither does Holden, is it an economic model, nor is it a population model. I do not think people in Holden represent the cross-section of America, of our economic society, whether on Maslow scale or whatever scale it is. Yeah. And we can't use ourselves as a laboratory to decide what's going to satisfy us, what will satisfy, what will work in the world.
Yeah.
I was going to offer what the business manager of the village to say that Holden only survives through the $150,000 worth of gifts that it receives every year from the outside. So, and then to Diane's question about the Western European countries, why their economic structures appears to be working so well. And I don't know this, but in talking to people there, it's very difficult to be in those countries. It would be very difficult for a 500,000 El Salvadoran refugees to leave to Norway. Their populations are very controlled. It's a small amount of people on large amounts of land, and that it's very difficult to. I kind of wonder. And Scott has talked with me a lot about Norway and their quality of life is so good that, you know, the goal for many people is to get to Norway. If you can get there and be accepted under whatever basis, you're pretty much taken care of for life. Mm-hmm. And so they're very careful about who they let there. So that starts to feel pretty exclusive. And then when I thought about Holden's much the same way. There's usually more people want to come here and stay longer term than the place can sustain. And if they were to stay here a lifetime, then there'd be 70 people, and that would be it. And so I'm wondering, is that true? Is that one of the negatives of those economic systems, is that they feel pretty exclusive?
Very homogeneous societies.
They do not allow pluralism. Most of them are. We lived in Australia and New Zealand for 14 years. Raleigh has a lot of relations in Australia. Australia is very diverse, semi-socialist kind of country, and it's very strong economically. And yeah, I thought Canada might also be, but Australia has absorbed vast numbers of refugees from not only Eastern Europe, but also from Southeast Asia.
But only recently. Only in the last decade.
Oh, no. No. Long ago.
Well, okay, but in our modern times, they were very much anti-Asian immigration during the early and middle 80s.
During when?
The early, the 70s and 80s. They've had to open up.
Yeah,
for
they
all kind of
they,
reasons, but they were.
They have opened up at various times. Granted, there have been times when their immigration has been very exclusive, but at times they have also opened up very broadly. And my point is not how liberal their immigration policy is at any given moment, but that they have absorbed some very diverse cultures. In Melbourne, for instance, the street signs are in three languages. One's Malay.
But is New Zealand that way?
New Zealand is not that way, to their detriment.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I seldom hear Australia or Canada upheld as major economic models for the world, like I hear Switzerland, Norway, Sweden. West Germany, I think, is going to be the fascinating thing to watch because of its opening to West Germany. I don't know, were there millions of people fleeing there and they were getting 40 marks? Is that?
They were getting the equivalent of $150, I think,
yeah.
U.S.
No, they're spending money.
Just to come in.
I
a lot of that being funded by the United States.
That seems like an exception. I think economically it's going to be really interesting to watch the two Germany. Western Germany has been so economic.
Well, the people who are fleeing, I understand, many of the professional people who bring skills and great, great human resources to West Germany.
Well, what drives a particular type of economy? I mean, I'm just responding to what I've heard. This is really fascinating because I've never thought about economics that very much. And I'm hearing you say that there are some basic things that drive a particular type of economy. And if so, are those values or lack of values or what is it? Is that at the heart of what a new economy or could possibly be? Would it be the value rather than the lack of value that would drive it? Or?
I think politics drives economics.
Right now.
And that's why I think that, you know, Jane has cited a wonderful vision. The industrialist state. We're going to do away with industrial society. But she pointed out that two-thirds of the world doesn't have it. The other third does. Now, let's look at how the other two-thirds live. And they don't live particularly like you want to live today. Maybe not. I can't use this group as the laboratory. You have a different value system.
I don't know if that's fair. Can you say that the way we live, you know, that's the model for living in the world?
I'm not saying that. But what I'm trying to say is the way they live, is it's going to be difficult to sell our population, our political body, that's how they want to live. Not necessarily how we're living now. Particularly, it's going to be difficult to sell it to those who are living on the margin of our political society, and that is a growing amount of our population. It is really growing, the margin of our industrial society. So we got to get there somehow. You know, how do you transit? You just don't rip out this industrial society and replace it with.
That's the question.
And it's terrible. It's the means versus ends.
Something on here. There's some people wanting to get in. Mm-hmm. Stick yours first.
Oh, I was just going to address that given that there are limits to capitalism, which is somewhat what we're talking about pertaining to ecology, there's only so much that you can exploit the earth. And it seems like we're talking about a new economic order. And given who controls power in our United States, and that is the control of money, the control of information, how we get our information, the control of force, those are really strong powers. And so what steps do you need to do to implement social change, like in the next 10 years? And it's easy to say we need a new economic order, but where do you start?
I think you can talk about change. You know, what are mechanisms for change? And this is just perhaps in one model, but you can take a confrontational approach. Greenpeace, they're out there stopping those whaling boats, and they're making such a fuss about it that the whaling boats are stopping. You can confront. It's one way of forcing change. You can make change remedially. You work within to gradually change. And that's a lot of what would have to happen now. People have to be engaged in that. There's no way tomorrow you make a difference. But change also occurs by building the alternative. And you disempower what's in power because you have created something alternative. And so I'm arguing for this as a method for change. At the same time saying, of course you cannot overnight do that. But if you set your steps in that direction, as this builds, this collapses.
So in other words, almost a revolution.
Well, it's a gradual revolution, yeah. It is. You can use it, but the word frightens everybody, so you don't. But it is. It's a revolution that happens because you disempower what's important. And I think that's happening in 1,000 different ways around the world.
And I'm afraid that it's going to happen through a catastrophic collapse. That's how a lot of change has happened, that what we have will fall apart and people will look around for something new. And hopefully there'll be enough new things that we can start to build a new model. That may be pessimistic.
Okay, Becky, and then we'll get George.
Okay. What drives economics may be politics, but what drives politics is a system of values, and it's images, and it's a mythology. And I think that is what needs to be addressed. That's what needs to be changed. And one, which is what Jane is saying too, another possible way of, on a very practical level, of addressing that is through the media, through writing, through the arts. It's somehow I think we need to get at this illusion that America, for example, is living under, that people really do live for money. And that is what motivates people. And that is what makes an economy work. Somehow we need to get at that. And just in answer to some of the questions about Holden and other examples, the reason I brought up some examples wasn't so much that these are models that are viable across the board, large scale economically, but to show that people can live for a different set of values, and that sort of context can work and can be really satisfying to humans.
Okay, we take yours.
Addressing the driving force of economics again, seems to me it's usually self-interest that people act on. That's why you have Brazilian peasants cutting down rainforests and grazing cattle, because that's how they can feed their family. And same thing in other parts of the two-thirds world where people need firewood, and so they're destroying the forest in order, not seeing, you know, beyond the next decade, but just wanting to cook their meal for tonight. And seeing a TV report on the new McDonald's going up in Moscow, they're going to retrain the workers there, who apparently are notoriously slow in the cafeteria lines, and teach them that some incentive programs, by if they can be faster, then they will be paid accordingly and have more money. And then recognizing that our kind of the crisis situation where we're at in regards to the environment, that we can't sustain this type of consumption. How do we change our attitudes from self-interest to looking at what can we sustain in the earth today?
Okay. Remind me your name.
Rick.
Yeah.
If we think of economic systems as how decisions get made about resource use and other things, then I think we need to consider where the locus of power is, where the locus of power is within that decision-making system. And it really lies within the corporations that Jerry was talking about earlier. If we really think about who holds genuine economic and political power in this country and in this world, we're kidding ourselves if we don't recognize the fact that these corporations control a lot of the political system here and throughout the world and control a lot of the economic system. In a sense, it's almost a joke to think of the United States as a democracy if we don't recognize how much genuine power is in the hands of these corporations. Many of them have gross national products that put them ahead of most of the other countries of the world is that corporation. So we have, in a sense, I think, abdicated power to these corporations. And if we pick up on your commentary about holding corporations responsible for their action, and then there must be some way to take back some of that power and to make them responsible to where the decision making ought to be. That will not be easy. Kurt,
well, you're repeating a lot of what some of
the Carol said.
You've heard it.
Well, I guess an observation as to maybe what everybody would hope to see in all of the discussion so far here is a bit more morality and decision-making and to go along with self-interest or to replace self-interest is maybe another question. And I would be concerned. I mean, I was intrigued by your comment concerning how to make corporations more responsible and having, trying to return to the original definition of a corporation being something that's serving the interests of something other than themselves as well. I would be concerned with how to enforce that sort of morality. Because it's easy for us to say, well, Christian morality is something that could serve us well in our economic decision making. But certainly there are a lot of non-Christians in the world and in the United States. And,
yeah, I'd like to address that.
And another observation that Jane made was that Greenpeace is out there sort of confronting the whalers and affecting the change. And it's interesting, and an interesting observation is that their morality is just sort of stands by itself. It's sort of like, guys, it's obvious, we're running out of whales, you can't do this, and nobody can refute that. And maybe that's what makes them effective in terms of popular opinion about what they're doing. And one more observation concerning the time scale. It seems that perhaps our economic decision making could be improved by considering longer timescales with certain use of our resources. Like what's good for tomorrow is not necessarily good for 10 years from now or something like that. And we, as a comfortable, developed country, are in a position to do something about that and should. But to ask people of a country that are denuding their hillside for firewood so they can cook tonight's meal to do something about that is damn presumptuous of it.
All right, Dick? We're about at the end of our time, too.
Social responsibility. Corporations are very aware of their stakeholders,
employees, suppliers, banks, publics. The state, the concern to the society in general is that they can continue to be enfranchised to do business. Because when society decides that business is doing bad, they quit buying. Notice cigarette companies and there's what's happened to cigarettes. More and more, corporations are publishing social responsibility audits, not voluntarily, not because they're mandated by law. And you would say, well, yeah, but what's in those things? The things that's in those are to make them look good as public relations and so forth. But some of it has to be factual. All I'm trying to say is there is the concept of social responsibility and an audit and a published report. Now, they have to publish a financial audit. It's required by the have to publish it to the Securities and Exchange Commission. It is a law. They do so. It wouldn't be that difficult to have a law that says they have to publish a social responsibility audit. And it would be, you'd have a process for doing that. Now, how do you bring that sort of thing about? You bring it about through the ballot box. We scapegoat the corporation, and rightly so, because there's such big targets to shoot at, and there's plenty of reason to shoot at them. I don't want to make any excuses for them. But what I'm trying to get to is, we just got through, after 8 years of Ronald Reagan, we voted in another pro-business administration. And once they get in, we're liable to have 8 more years of it. The public stood up and voted them in. We're going to do this thing at the ballot box. And I think that's our most immediate direction to do it, is at the ballot. Look at the Greens have done in Western Europe. I think we have to maybe quit. Those people function only at the discretion of the publics. We are the publics. We've got to attack it from that direction. Instead of throwing everything over there and saying, it's their fault, do away with them. Let's try and bring them under control. Let's try and do something with them. Let's try and regulate them more. Let's get to the ballot box and be responsible citizens and express what we're doing in terms of our votes.
Also, to that note of working with corporations is the use of proxy and having people who go to the stockholders meeting or people who don't go but finding someone who does and having them vote for you in a certain way. And some corporations have had to listen to mm-hmm. what the stockholders are saying, and so that's a possibility is making corporations responsible. And it's a small way.
Well, I think we've explored a number of interesting dimensions here that not any one of us would have thought of all on our own. And that's been, for me at least, it's been a very useful session. So I want to thank you all for that. And those of you who've got a compulsion to want to talk a little bit more, let's hang around and do some of that. Some of us have got other things to do. I've got to go get the clothes out of the washer and into the dryer here. Some of that seems good. Thank you very much. Let me remind you that there's a video at 11 o'clock, the change starting, that will be highlights from the North American Conference on Christianity and Ecology. It'll be right here. Change? Right here.
Yeah. It's been very good.